Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. At least 9 people, including a police officer, have been killed in the Indian state of Gujarat over caste-related protests and riots. Upper caste Gujaratis, known as Patels or the Patidar community, have brought their state's main city, Ahmedabad, to a standstill over what they perceive as unfair treatment. India's affirmative action programs aimed at tribal and Dalit people are aimed at undermining casteism. But now Gujarat's Patels say they've had enough. According to the BBC, internet services on mobile phones have been suspended, schools and businesses are closed, and public transport cancelled in Ahmedabad and other parts of the state. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who hails from Gujarat, appealed for calm, saying that violence had, quote, never done good for anyone. Ironically, it was under Mr. Modi's watch that Gujarat saw its worst violence more than a decade ago, when a pogrom by fundamentalist Hindus against the state's Muslim community left thousands dead. Joining me now is Thenmori Soundararajan. She is a Dalit American filmmaker and transmedia artist, co-founder of the International Women's Media Technology Collective, Third World Majority. Welcome to Uprising, Thenmori.
Hi, good morning, Sonali. Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. A young man named Hardik Patel, Thenmori, is at the forefront of this movement of upper caste Gujaratis, and he was arrested on Tuesday. His arrest sparked rioting. He's claiming that the Patidar community, this is the upper caste community of Indians, is equivalent to a tribal or a Dalit caste, and he wants this classification so that his community can take advantage of the quota system and the affirmative action policies that India has had. Why does this community, which is at the top of the sort of socioeconomic ladder in India and has been historically, why do they feel so oppressed? Aren't they the privileged caste?
Well, I think that's really what the conversation needs to be about, is their incredible privilege. So when we're talking about the Patel community, we have to recognize their incredible wealth diasporically, but also they are a land-owning caste in Gujarat. Like the entire origin of the term Patidar, which gave rise to the Patel caste, means entitlement. And so their penetration in terms of multiple industries, from the diamond industry to business to the government, and the amount of positions that they've had in terms of the state legislature, is they are in control without doubt. So for them to kind of say that they're in a position that requires reservation really betrays the idea of what reservation was meant to restore. And, you know, for American audiences, reservation is the affirmative action policy in India that was meant to address the generations of violence and caste discrimination that many Dalits and other backward castes faced under caste apartheid. So it's a restorative policy meant to try to give Dalits an even footing in with regards to the entire infrastructure of India being based within this de facto apartheid system.
Now, so I should add a note on terms. The Indian government has long used the term OBC, which, believe it or not, for our audience, stands for the other backward classes, in reference to groups that have historically been disadvantaged. So the Patels want to be labeled, quote, backward too, so that they can take advantage of these programs. One writer declared the affluent Patel clan owns a quarter of U.S. motels in India. It wants to be called backward. How do you respond to that, Thenmori?
Well, I mean, I think that's why this is really a disingenuous conversation, because when you hear his ask is that either Patels get are able to be qualified as OBCs and get reservation, or all reservations need to be abolished.
And what by reservation, you mean essentially explain that term.
So reservation, once again, is the affirmative action policy in India.
So it's like a quota.
Yes, that basically allows for a certain position of government positions, of school admissions, and other kind of like state subsidies to be guaranteed to those who have a harder access to getting those services or those positions because of structural oppression. And I think that the conversation about reservation always gets seen that unqualified, you know, lower caste candidates are taking these positions. But I think one thing that none of these arguments ever deal with is the fact that caste atrocity is still unabated in the state of Gujarat. So when we're talking about caste violence and untouchability practice in Gujarat, there was a recent report by the Navsarjan Trust done by the Robert Kennedy Center for Human Rights that said 98% of villages in Gujarat still practice untouchability. There's been a 500 increase of rape of Dalit women in 2014 since 2001. And 90% of all of the cases around caste atrocity are still pending in Gujarat cases. So whatever slights that the Patel community feels that they are unable to access these government positions, they are without a doubt not facing the systemic structural violence of caste atrocity and caste-based sexual violence that prevents many Dalits and other backward communities from being able to fully engage with these structures that allow people to progress.
So what you're saying is that even if we set aside the demands by the Patidar community, who are at the top of the caste system in India, that there is a very severe level, an epidemic level of violence from upper castes aimed at lower castes in India, so-called lower castes, the Dalit communities in India, that doesn't seem to be as important an issue for them to take up.
Absolutely. And I think that it's really, you know, once again, when you look at the history of the Patel community, they had a series of protests in the 80s that were against reservation. So a lot of like how I view this recent outrage is not so much about them being demanding reservation, but it's a continuing conversation within their community to abolish this affirmative action policy as a whole. And I think that we, all of those who stand with Dalit and OBC communities and people who believe that there needs to be a restorative process for those who've been impacted by caste apartheid, we kind of see the wolf in sheep's clothing here. And we know that this is not the way to go. And nor is this a candidate that should have the kind of support by, you know, liberal-minded people.
Hmm. Time magazine described the community, the Patidar community or Patels, in these terms. The Patels run several small and medium businesses, not just in India, but in the U.S., Europe, and Africa. They're also key players in India's diamond trade and have been major supporters of the Bharatiya Janata Party that Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi belongs to since the late 1980s. This is, of course, a fundamentalist party, and Narendra Modi, who is not a Patel, but certainly has been supported by this community. He is, him and his supporters represent a fundamentalist ideology. That is also something that needs to be part of the conversation, right?
And absolutely. And I think that it's really interesting because, you know, a lot of the work that we've been doing with the campaign, the Dalit Women Fight, and the work with the All India Dalit Women's Rights Forum has really been to show the links of how fundamentalism in the diaspora and casteism of communities in the diaspora is very, very connected to fundamentalism that breeds within our home countries. And the reality is that when you have Patels here and other upper caste members here say that they are casteless, when in fact they're supporting their families to continue this conversation, this is one clear point of intervention where we can really, as a global South Asian progressive community, start to create a counter narrative. You know, that if we really want to end caste, if we really want to annihilate caste, it's not about ending reservation, it's about ending caste supremacy. And this is exactly one of those examples.
Now, inside Gujarat, the current chief minister, who is also a Patel, which is an indication actually of that community's influence, that, you know, one member of their community is actually in the highest position in the state, Anandibeen Patel, he has so far refused the demands of the Patel community to be seen as a caste that can take advantage of the reservation system. If he were to give in, then the affirmative action policies, the quotas, would mean nothing, would they?
Well, I mean, I think that this is why they've really kind of like backed themselves into a corner, because Gujarat currently is at capacity for reservation, and reservation as a restorative policy was not meant to keep people who have land, who have power, who are enactors of violence, to then have reprivileged positions within institutions to better help their economics. So I think it's a total sham. And I think once again, they know that they're not going to get their concession. And so this is really a larger question, not to include them into reservation, but to abolish reservation as a whole. And that's why I think that Dalits and other people that are aligned around the question of keeping restorative policies to address the violence of the caste apartheid system really see that this is a wolf in sheep's clothing argument, and that we can't really afford to be distracted by this.
And then, Marie, can we draw an analogy to the U.S., where some white Americans have railed against the very weak and modest affirmative action policies around the country because they feel that it disadvantages them, even though they have all of society's advantages? We've seen affirmative action cases at the Supreme Court over this. It seems like it's a similar thing.
Well, and there's really interesting. There was an article in the New York Times that led with the story of the young woman who got denied access to UT Austin, denied in air quotes, of course.
Who's at the heart of the Supreme Court case? Yeah,
right, exactly. And the New York Times used that as an entry to discuss the Brahmins that were being discriminated against in respect to the reservation policies, right? And so I think that there's a lot of people that try to make that analogy, but I think if you really are going to make the analogy between caste and race, you have to look at the structural nature of racism in the United States and the structural nature of casteism within India. And when you're talking about, you know, structural aspects of casteism in India, you're looking at like 100% of all corporate boards being made up of upper caste people. You're talking about 100% of all of the boards of all of the major media institutions being owned and represented by upper caste people. You're also talking about less than 1% of all journalists being Dalits, you know? So I don't actually feel like we're getting accurate representation in both the U.S. and in India. And I think particularly in the U.S., like really it was only, I think, with the conversation in Black Lives Matters that there's been an even more deeper investigation with white supremacy and its denial of the violence that has allowed the structural supremacy of white communities within all of our policies. So in many ways, I think that while there is this legal narrative that's happening, the on-the-ground grassroots narrative that really keeps the center on the lives that are at the heart of this these violent systems are really what are continuing to kind of keep the importance of the need for these restorative policies in place.
There was an interesting statement made by a Patel who works for Amnesty International's office in India, Akar Patel. He's a political commentator, and he said to the LA Times, "It's laughable. They, meaning Patels, have had access to modernity and capital for a century and a half. Almost every person in central Gujarat, where Patels dominate, has family members in the US and UK." And I think, Thenmori, this goes back to what you were saying about the sort of international links that this Patel community has had. And, you know, most Americans are familiar with, you know, there's, of course, the stereotypical Patel owner of the motels here. And even if within the United States, Patels aren't, motel owners aren't necessarily reaching the upper levels of the 1% in the United States, relative to India, there's certainly a lot of privilege.
No, without a doubt. And I think this is like the real call to action with this story, is that the longer that those of us who are South Asian in the diaspora deny the existence of caste, like amongst our ranks, the longer that we keep silence about how we create a climate of compliance and also financial support for caste atrocity, caste apartheid, and Hindu fundamentalism in our home countries. And I think it's a real call to action for those communities that are upper caste, that are members of the Patel, to really change and shift the narrative. Because really, I think that, you know, caste apartheid is a system that's been in existence for thousands of years. And for us to end this in our lifetime, we need to be able to start naming the silence that really exists around the continuity of caste, and really just breaking it once and for all. And in the words of Dr. Ambedkar, we must educate, agitate, and organize so that we can annihilate caste in our lifetime.
And explain for our American audiences who Dr. Ambedkar was.
So Dr. Ambedkar is the Dalits leader who is our equivalent of both a Martin Luther King and a Malcolm X. But he was this incredible towering figure who not only wrote the Indian Constitution, but really paved the way for having a man of letters who could speak to so many disciplines of what our liberation can look like. And he had a correspondence with W.E.B. Du Bois. He was one of the first Indians to attend Columbia. And my sense is that the more people know about the Dalit intellectual tradition and they know about figures like Dr. Ambedkar, the more that they know that there is a deep historical challenge to caste apartheid, and the less likely they're going to fall for people like Hardik Patel that are just kind of spinning stories to be able to continue their privilege and ignore the violence that continues caste apartheid in Gujarat.
And Ambedkar is spelled A-M-B-E-D-K-A-R, if our audience wants to look that name up. Now, speaking of violence, that's exactly what has been playing out in Gujarat this week. I mentioned 9 people and a police officer killed. There are riots in Gujarat right now that are being characterized as the worst caste-based violence to hit Gujarat in more than a decade. What does that violent response mean? How significant is it that a community with privilege that is demanding more privilege is using so much violence to assert itself?
Well, I think this is the terrible, tragic reality, is that when we see forward castes like the Patels enact violence in the public sphere like this, it is only a reminder of the kind of violence that they've waged against Dalit communities for centuries. Mm-hmm. When we talk about acts of caste-based sexual violence that look at people being paraded naked, being burned, being raped or stripped naked in public, when we're talking about the kinds of massacres that we saw of other religious minorities in the Gujarat riots, the idea of dominant caste using violence to make political points is the reality that cements caste apartheid. That is, in fact, caste terror, and it's the heart of caste atrocity. So to see it bubbling in this way is heartbreaking, and my heart goes out to the communities that are Dalit and other Bahujan communities in Gujarat, because the target for them, I think for these Patels, once they get done with the state, will be our communities.
Right.
Because that's already the conversation that's happening. These are unqualified people taking our positions. And as they go to these protests in these very expensive cars to show strength that they actually are weak, that need a reservation, the whole thing is like a total farce, you know.
Tenmori, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your analysis with us.
Oh, sure. Thank you very much. And I just encourage people, as they start to explore this issue, to also start to look at the growing conversation about the diaspora saying no to Modi and the Modi protests that are going to be coming onto the West Coast at the end of September.
Thank you. This is
really the time to really not just engage with this question in Gujarat, but look at the state of Hindu fundamentalism in India as a whole.
Thank you so much. And you can follow my guest Tenmori on Twitter at Dalit Diva. Tenmori Sandararajan is a Dalit American filmmaker and transmedia artist, co-founder of the International Women's Media Technology Collective, Third World Majority.